Welcome to the American Citizen Summit, where respected political leaders, grassroots visionaries, and other pioneers are charting the course toward a healthier political culture which expresses America's founding ideals of liberty, equality, and justice for all. Please share this event with your friends and family, and join us on Facebook at The Shift Network. And now your host, Amanda Catherine Roman, CTG Associates.
Welcome, everyone. We are so glad that you are joining us. I'm very excited to introduce our special guest today with our Building Relationships in Public Spaces conversation. Today, we have Debbie Lynn Molyneux, Liz Joyner, and Pete Peterson joining us. Debbie Lynn Molyneux works with visionaries and movements in support of a new national and global social contract. Her work highlights the relationships between individuals, institutions, and governments for conscious transformation. She is the president of Coffee Party USA, the managing partner for Living Room Conversations, and the co-director for Bridge Alliance. Liz Joyner is the executive director of The Village Square, a community-based model for improving civil discourse by focusing on building relationships between divided groups inside American hometowns. And Pete Peterson is the dean of the Pepperdine School of Public Policy, the former executive director of the Davenport Institute for Public Engagement and Civic Leadership at Pepperdine, and the 2014 Republican candidate for California Secretary of State. In each of these roles, Pete has been a consistent advocate for the value of legitimate public engagement in producing better, more creative policy solution and better, more engaged citizens committed to the hard work of self-governance. So it is a great pleasure to have all of you joining us today, and I'd like to welcome you. And we're going to give a few moments for each of you to tell us why you're excited to be here for the American Citizen Summit and talking about your work of building relationships in public spaces. So Debbie Lynn, I'd love to start off with you.
Sure. Thanks, Amanda. And glad to be here with Liz and Pete as well. I think this idea of the American Citizen Summit's been, been around for a few years, and so I'm really glad to have this kind of virtual format where people of any means can get connected in with what's happening and also see some positive stories about our country in ways that we are working together in sharp contrast to what I expect the Democratic and GOP conventions are. So if nothing else, it's a better way for us to start working together.
Fabulous. Thank you so much, Debbie Lynn. And Liz, why don't we hop on over to you to hear a little bit more about your work with The Village Square?
Thanks, Amanda. So we've been at this about a decade, and one of the things that I'm so excited about this opportunity, as much as to share what we've been doing in hometowns, is frankly even to talk with Pete and Debbie Lynn today is exciting because of the fact that we get an opportunity to share, experiences, how-tos, tips, tricks of the trade across a broad group of people who are really doing some amazing work. And I think it's exciting. I think it's kind of a meta story here that we are connecting citizens to each other to address this problem. It's sort of what American democracy is all about. So I think that's exceptionally cool.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that. And Pete, tell us a little bit more about your work.
Yeah, so I'm based here at a policy school at Pepperdine, and most of my work has been with municipal officials at the state and local level. And why I'm so excited to participate in this call is that I've always seen public engagement as a bridge that needs to be built from both banks, both from the citizen side in attempting to connect with government, but also from the government side in attempting to connect with its citizens. And most of my work has been on the government side, and it's a very exciting time, despite what the news may be saying, for public policy around how we better engage and inform our residents. And so to be in a space like this, looking at the bridge being built from both banks, it's a really exciting time.
Pete, I'd like to really pick up on that theme. You know, I've heard you refer to the silver tsunami before, and I know that, as you just referenced, there's so much happening in local and state government that's promoting that greater public engagement. So can you speak a little bit more to that?
Right. So the silver tsunami was a term coined in Governing Magazine, which is the leading state and local government magazine, to describe what is a historic retirement of baby boomers out of the public sector workforce. What this means for government is that in many areas of state and local government, in the next few years, we're going to see over 50% of the current leadership of state and local government retire. And so seen in one sense, that really could be a crisis. And I think in many quarters, it's seen as a crisis. But for those of us in the policy school world, it's also an incredible opportunity to understand that we're going to have entirely new leadership of our state and local and even federal government in the next 5 to 10 years. And so the question becomes, are we going to just simply change younger generation for older generation, or are we actually going to use this as an opportunity to change how we do government? And I think that opportunity is there. And given some of the work that we're doing here at Pepperdine and certainly the work of the others on this call, I think we're looking at a new generation of leadership that can really change how government is done. So, it's a historic opportunity given the fact that we are going to see this transition in leadership from the local government all the way up to the federal government.
Yeah, I think that is an amazing opportunity. I know Liz and Debbie Lynn, much of the work that you guys are doing in the communities you work in is really working with a number of these new leaders that are in the not in the government spaces, in more of community or advocacy spaces. So can you guys talk a little bit about what you've learned about working in-person and online communities? Maybe Debbie Lynn, you could address that. And Liz, if you could also join in with how the Village Square communities are really working to make these changes a reality in a community-by-community approach.
Sure, this is Debbie Lynn. I think one of the things that Coffee Party has done in the 6.5 years or so that we've been around is we've provided an opportunity for people who've been disengaged from government and from politics to kind of dip their toe in a very safe environment, whether they're initially engaging with us on our Facebook page with where we have over 1 million followers, or whether they're deciding to actually become a member or volunteer of Coffee Party. We help people kind of move from their training wheels, if you will, to full-on activists and engagement with their government officials. And there's I've watched several volunteers actually move through our system where initially they feel like they just didn't have a voice. They didn't know what to do. They didn't feel educated enough to participate in the system. And through their continued volunteer work with the Coffee Party and engagement with all of us, they went on to work on campaigns or develop relationships with their local elected officials. And so for me, I always feel like Coffee Party is a little bit of the waiting pool that for people who don't want to just dive in the deep end like I did. and it's a really gentle way, if you will, to help people re-engage with our government and recognize that we, the citizens, are the government. It's not something separate from us, and really helping to make those connections again.
Absolutely. That's a great distinction, Debbie Lynn. And Liz, why don't you tell us a little bit about your community-by-community approach with Village Square?
So I think that the unique story of how we started is probably a good metaphor to use for what we do and how we do it. Initially, there was a very contentious community debate about whether to build a coal plant. And through the conversation occurring over a course of many months, people who were actually both for and against the coal plant got to get a sense of the fact that there was sort of no there to take this conversation. It tended to get kind of, you fall into sort of the normal feuding national tribes, having very little to do with really what was going on in our hometown. And so I think there was sort of a collective, there has to be some way for average people to get together. There, in many ways, it really is the rebirth of the quintessential American town hall. And so that's what we set our sights on doing. And really, so we're kind of the quote-unquote brick-and-mortar part of this. We're the citizen part of the bridge that Pete described. And, in fact, we are specifically working with Davenport in building that bridge and a demonstration project in the city of Palmdale in California. Working to bring the citizens in into a new kind of conversation engagement, really relationship first. So we're talking about very kind of retail, all politics is local kind of relationship building, in the sense that there's kind of something that comes before making policy decisions. It's the relationship between people and the community that provides kind of a center of gravity, a ballast of democracy that has more naturally existed in the past and now really has to be intentionally rebuilt. And that's what we do, and the reason we do it, you know, our community, our unit of intervention is a community, because we think that that's a place where you can get in there, you can really do some work that then starts to you know, exponentially expand in its influence.
And I think it's beautiful to hear about the ways that your different communities and organizations are working together, and in each of the spaces and places that you three are working, you really all have this localized approach to community and public engagement. And I think that you would all agree that it is helping and supporting to heal a lot of the polarized political culture that we are living in. And so I'd love to do just a roundtable here, and we'll start with Pete, on how it's the relationship building aspect of that approach that is really helping the national dialogue and the national political culture from where you sit within your organization and your work. So Pete, let's start off with you.
Yeah, Amanda, so what I see in a lot of the projects that we work on with cities and counties is that many of the policy issues that we work on don't have an obvious partisan element to them, right? So if you're talking about schools, if you're talking about issues around budgets and how they're spent, if you're talking about land use policy and what our city is going to look like, what's interesting about the work that I get to do and the people that I interact with is that the participants in these processes may vote in very different ways when it comes to a presidential election, but there are interesting coalitions that are built when you actually get to the issues that are affecting them at the local level. And because of that, and because some of these issues are really so personal, right? We're sending our kids to schools. We have different needs as it pertains to public safety and parks. I mean, these are all issues that are really affect us on a day-to-day basis. What I tend to see is that there's much more of a willingness to collaborate, especially when you're actually brought face-to-face with your neighbors, as so many of the projects that we do, and I know the others here on the call, this really is about first building relationships on a face-to-face basis, as opposed to some of these national issues in which, A, we're disconnected from the policy levers that actually affect these issues, and B, some of those issues don't really affect us as deeply as some of these issues that occur at the more local level. So what we hope is that in finding these points of collaboration at the local level, which don't have an obvious partisan element to them, that we can begin to pull out some of the anger that we tend to see when these very same people that work together on a local issue have a conversation about something at a national issue.
Yeah, this is Liz. If I can jump in, our experience at the Village Square has been exactly the same. And we think that it is, so it's not only a strength, in a way we've allowed the big national issues that really don't have repercussions in our community decision-making to divide us, whereas you can flip that around and instead create a situation where in hometowns we're working on what isn't so difficult. It's an easier lift. It's sort of knowing where to walk in the door of a relationship. And once you're there and once you're on the same team in the sense that you're neighbors together and you share a common fate that your community shares, then all of a sudden the bigger issues that have divided us are a little bit more easy to have a go at inside of newly formed relationships. And so we have exactly the same philosophy of sort of the door in, not just to improving communities, but improving the country.
And this is Debbie Lynn. And I think one of the things that we're doing with Coffee Party is actually providing a place for people to practice those conversations on the national issues, because you know we don't have you know a large section of local communities. We have a bunch of individuals that are scattered across the country, and what brings us together are our concerns for some of the national issues, and then the impact that those national issues might have in the local communities. But it's we talk about it inside Coffee Party using our muscle of civility, which for us is basically is mutual respect and a lack of denigration of others. And it's been very interesting to watch people grow in their practice of civil discourse and how that makes it possible then for them to go and have work on campaigns or have connections with their elected officials. And some of them actually do, as you guys are talking, like get involved at their local level with issues that are very pertinent to their individual lives.
We call it a muscle too, interestingly enough. And sort of the notion is that you can't, just like any muscle, you can't call upon it in a very difficult situation, expect it to perform well if you haven't exercised it. Excuse me.
Right.
Yeah, no, and what I was just going to say is that even at the local focus, I just wanted to put one caveat on there, is that the process really does matter, right? So even at the local level, what we found is that if the only way to engage your government is at a city council meeting, our public comment process is broken. For a couple different reasons. One is that these are usually timed comments, right? So people already show up at these meetings and they have their typed out, perfectly timed 2 or 3 minute comment that they're going to hold forth and make sure that the council or decision-making body listens to. And second, there's not even an opportunity for citizens to engage with other citizens. So there's never an opportunity there for citizens to understand that whatever their very personally and even appropriately held view is on a particular policy issue, even at the local level, if that's not put into a process where you're going to have to discuss with a fellow citizen who may have a different perception of that issue, then you're still not really getting towards the eventual goal, which is building community and forming more effective and sustainable policy decisions. So that the one caveat I just want to put on there is that even at the local level where some of these issues, as I said before, are not as partisan and, you know, you can really build some unique relationships with those that you would otherwise disagree with, our public comment process, and that's why most all the work that we do, and I know that Liz and Debbie Lynn also were involved in, is finding spaces outside of public comment to build those relationships, because the public comment process is ironically one of the least engaging ways of soliciting the feedback and opinion of your residents.
I'm really glad that you... Go ahead. Debbie Lynn.
Just Debbie Lynn here again. I wanted just to comment, Pete, on that. I think a lot of what we're seeing with the unrest in the country right now with the agitators and the protesters is because we all know that public comment process is broken, and not just broken, but that the deal has probably already been made in the back room, and that this is a legislated obligation of our elected officials to sit there and pretend to listen to people, and it's usually the same 12 people,
right,
talk 2 minutes at the microphone. And it's so unpleasant for the rest of the citizens that they don't even bother to show up anymore. And so
right.
I think this notion of having an alternate process that is real engagement, where the city officials are actually involved in the process and not just patronizing the citizens for saying, oh, that's really nice that you guys came up with this, but we've already made the deal. I think it is hugely important and will definitely, I think, decrease the number of agitators and protesters that are required because they're just calling out a corrupt system.
Yeah, and in fact, we've had at the Village Square, we've had a lot of kind of interesting experience with engaging the very people who very often the agitants speaking to the councils in the process, and it really does turn everything around because really, you're right. That's what they're doing. They're sort of increasing their volume as it's just really not whatever they believe in isn't being sort of inserted into the body politic as part of a conversation, both with elected leaders, but then also with other citizens. And that's a lot of what we do is we're just continually sort of seeding that soil and having those connection points. We do an annual town hall meeting that's very kind of friendly and informal, and we have pizza, and we have an annual speed date your local leaders forum, which is just exactly what it sounds like, that people really just love to come to. And so you're creating just many more, you're creating much more social civic glue by doing that, then the glue is there and it can work in other ways.
Well, and I just want to just make a quick note on that. Just from the government side, government officials know that it's broken too, right?
Yeah.
We actually did survey work on this here in the state of California with the League of California Cities. And on a series of different questions around the public comment process, I mean, we were looking at 70 to 80% of public officials saying that their public process, their way of doing public engagement through public process was broken. So both citizens and public officials know that it's broken. The question is, and obviously that's the work that we're all about in different ways, because that's why we do the training work of public sector officials to say there is a different way to do it. But to highlight the fact that the problem might not just be the relationship between citizens and government. The problem might be the process by which we usually engage one another. And really to put the focus on the process and look at ways that can be improved to see if we can build better relationships.
And I think this is the key thing that I want to just pick up on, because Liz, you mentioned some specific examples. I think that our listeners could really benefit because you guys have all been very successful at designing or executing different processes that are enabling people to learn from one another when they have a different perspective or they're coming from a different sector. So it would be great if we could hear some more of those specific examples of what those processes look like and how we are, when we say there's different ways, can you give our listeners some flavor of what some of those things look like on the ground? Really, it's to all three of you, but I know, Liz, you mentioned like the speed dating of local leaders. I don't know if you have a couple other examples of the way that your events happen, and then Debbie Lynn and Pete can also join in.
So we're really pretty nimble about doing all sorts of different things, and rather than bore people with lots of different we have like different series on different things, and we look at different communities of people who we feel like are sort of outside of the process, and we find ways to walk towards them. So we have these local issue programming series, and one other thing that we do in that series other than the speed date and the town hall is we have a Club of Honest Citizens project that we do with our local county government that has been just incredible, and we used that this year to start addressing race issues, and we had a very diverse group who came together for that. And again, almost every time we sort of look at it and we say, what is the best way to create relationships and to draw in this very wide variety of people? And other than kind of going in heart first, relationship first rather than head first, one of the other sort of navigating central ideas that we have is that if you want people to show up these days, given the entertainment options we have, this just can't be your grandma's civics. You've got to give people a reason to show up and to get them in. Once you get them in, it's so much easier to keep them. So we actually really approach things with sort of very irreverent sort of sounding programming so that we draw interest and attention.
Fabulous. Debbie Lynn, did you want to add to that with some of the work that you're doing and some processes that have been helpful and successful?
Well, I think I'm gonna peel away from coffee party for just a second and talk about Living Room Conversations, one of the other hats that I work with, because Living Room Conversations is that process piece that you're talking about, and coffee party will actually be using it. You're starting in the fall to help people like connect at the heart, Liz, that you're talking about. And so we've had a group of people in Minnesota, in St. Paul, ironically enough, who've been working, talking about the race and ethnicity and doing a deeper dive on the relationship that they have with each other. And it's a very diverse group with white, black, biracial, all across the board. And the comments that we got back from just the first conversation were along the lines of, this is the first time I've ever been comfortable talking about race with a group of people, and the process there is so important, because we share a little bit about who we are and what our heart's desires are and what motivates and drives us in life before we ever talk about race or whatever the topic of the day is, because it could be on opportunity gap, it could be on criminal justice reform. There's lots and lots of conversations that are possible. And so I just want to say that that's part of practicing the muscle that we were talking about earlier, is actually engaging in these type of heart-centered conversations so that we like each other. And then once we like each other, it makes what I consider to be the harder work of arguing the policy point that much easier, because we really do want our new friends to also get what they need out of the process.
That's one of the reasons I'm a big fan of Living Room Conversations. And there's actually a wonderful historical American story about that very process really being used by then President Thomas Jefferson to save the Republic, that he would bring people in who had very substantial disagreements in governing for food and drink and conversation, and he actually very specifically went first for just the human connectedness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Pete, as at a policy school, I know that you're doing a lot to help train leaders so that they can lead in these more inclusive ways. So maybe you can speak a little bit to that for us.
Yeah, so about 5.5 years ago, along with a couple longtime public officials, we developed a training program called Public Engagement, the Vital Leadership Skill. And since then, we've had probably 12 or 1,300 public sector officials go through that training in various iterations, from webinar to half day to full day. And the reason we created it was really organically. We were consulting on a few public engagement projects and understood that while we might have one or two people in a city government who really did understand what we were trying to do, there wasn't an enterprise-wide understanding of it. And frankly, one of the things that I think policy schools have been known for is educating public experts. And if there's anything that we've seen both in our political discourse, but even issues that arise at the local level, is this distaste and really anger towards experts. And so the way that you try to thread that needle then is to do a better job of engaging your residents and involving them to the degree that you can in making some of these public decisions. And we realize that these are skills, whether it's facilitating or, as Liz was saying, even how you market these events, right? I mean, is this going to be a discussion around the general plan for Malibu, or are we going to call it a vision for the future of Malibu, right? And so these kinds of skills around facilitation and marketing and engaging and building processes around it are things that are only now being implemented into policy school curriculum. But we understood that there are hundreds of thousands of people out there working in local government that never got this education or training when they went through policy school. And so we created this training really to address that marketplace.
And actually, Pete, you just hit on one of the Village Square's little tips and tricks that maybe might be useful for us to share. and that is in your, you know, a vision for Malibu. But in doing that, in naming something a vision instead of something that feels very functional and work-like, you've done what we call hitting the hive switch. And so if you imagine that human beings, our hero, Dr. Jonathan Haidt of NYU, the author yeah. of The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Religion and Politics, talks about how human beings are 90% chimp, 10% bee, and the chimp is the sort of the, you know, we're operating our self-interest in an understandable way. But there, if you can punch the button on the back of all of our human heads that lets us become bee, where we see where we're working together for a common vision and idea, it inspires us. It essentially just almost immediately brings the better angels of our nature to the conversation,
right.
and helps you know, it helps it both be more productive, more civil, but also it helps people actually want to show up for it. And I think that in almost any endeavor that you're undertaking in the civic realm, if you ask yourself the question, how can we punch the hive switch, I think it will yield results.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that, Liz. And I wonder if you might add on to that some of the insights that you've gotten from the work that you're doing at Village Square on how some of the folks that are listening, if they're interested in bringing some of these strategies or processes or working in these mannerisms and in these processes in their communities, how they can increase the demand of the public, their neighbors, their friends, their family, for more events and civic content like this.
So I think one of the mistakes that maybe we make sometimes is we think of ourselves as being politically organized into self-interest groups. So, you know, we're doing whatever is in our self-interest. And in fact, this is where the chimp and bee thing works again. Really, we're more organized around in moral tribes. So it's more the hives that we operate in politically. We vote our morality. We, you know, hold certain things to be important and sacred together. And so if one of the tricks that we've used that has been just so it feels like it's addressing the problem in the right way and has been very productive, is we do something that we call moralizing democracy. So if we have feuding angry tribes that believe in different things are moral, there's actually something that we hold together as a moral good, and that is democracy, how it works, how we believe, and we tend to forget this, that differing opinions are actually really foundationally a strength in our democracy, and our founding fathers set it up that way. They you know, one of their greatest insights was seeing diversity of opinion as being a strength that helps you solve problems. And so if we say to people in our communities, this is a high ideal of American democracy, it then becomes something that we share, and it unites us rather than divides us. And I think it helps us kind of reform the American moral community around what, you know, really is an incredibly big idea in the world that is being challenged. And so, yes, we disagree inside that community, but frankly, that's the way it's supposed to work.
Yes.
Liz, as you're talking, about that, I'm reminded that, you know, despite the very public disagreements between Jefferson and Hamilton about the monetary system, or I'm forgetting some of the other ones, but they were vehemently opposed to different ideas of what was right for our country.
Right.
And yet, in the end, they still figured out how to work together. And a lot of the I would call it demonization of the other that they did in the press, was still put aside, if you will, for the good of the country. And I think that what you're speaking to with that American ideal is really making sure that we love our country more than we dislike or hate them.
Yeah,
that's the glue.
And that's such an inspiring idea. And I think sometimes we just assume that's all in place and we dive into our little silos, but it really isn't. There are some challenges now that we obviously have to address. And, you know, frankly, actually, I'm glad that you mentioned Hamilton, because I really think that one of the things that's so riveting to us about the play Hamilton is that it does moralize democracy. It helps us feel that heart connection to each other again. And then it also gives the Founding Fathers the variety of colors of faces that we should have had to begin with. And so it makes us feel excited for what we're doing. And we ought to be. This is important work. It's everything.
You know, Debbie Lynn, I know that a lot of your work is in the space of managing that ongoing dynamic tension between mm-hmm. conversation and dialogue and action. So could you speak to some tips or strategies that have been successful with your work that maybe our listeners could benefit from as well?
Oh, you say that, Amanda, like it's a fixed thing, because it really does change every single day. You know, some of the ongoing tension that we always have within coffee party is that as people move through the process of just kind of dipping their toe in and just wanting to do a couple of Facebook comments or showing up on appearing on a radio show and asking a guest question, moving from that to actually activating. As people go through that process, it creates a natural tension because not everybody's in the same place. Some people still want to stay in a safe dialogue space where we know that there's a moderation team in place or facilitator helping everything stay, you know, safe. You know, I use safe in quotes because it's sometimes not safe for others. And then sometimes they move to become the agitators or the activists, and they're like, come on, you know, come with us. And so for me, a lot of it is And within the coffee party, I have a very skilled group of volunteers. We're all volunteers in coffee party. And we have learned that that dynamic tension is good, because the people who still need to talk, kind of a microcosm of our national psyche of people who still need to talk about things. And then there's a group that's moving towards, I need to take action. I can't talk about this one more second. I need to do something. And we need to be able to accommodate and honor people where they are in their process within their engagement.
Yeah, and you know, Pete, I'm wondering if you might be able to share with us a little bit your thoughts from coming from the policy and government side of things, how that's playing out with our current election season and how it relates to that action component of maybe designing policy or creating policy, and how that interplay is taking place right now with our current cycle.
Well, that's a big question. I think in some ways, there was a watershed event with President Obama's first executive memorandum, which was specifically on the subject of government transparency and public engagement. And I think in writing that, what the president did was, in the very least, put a marker out there that this was going to be a way that we evaluate the effectiveness of government, even at the federal level. Now, what's transpired over the last 6 or 7 years, at least at the federal level, from having people I know who work in that at that level of government, you know, these are extremely hard practices to put into place, specifically public engagement. But in the very least, what the memorandum did was let everyone know in government, all of the bureaucracies and the agencies, that this was going to be a way that we understood the effectiveness of what we were doing, whether you're working for the EPA or you're working for the Department of Transportation. And it began to turn a ship that is very slowly turning at the federal level. But in many ways, it was an example, or at least a demonstration of work that's been happening at the local and state level for many years and continues to happen. There was a really good piece in the Stanford Social Innovation Review this past issue looking exactly at the subject of community engagement and how even with the most big data-driven policies that are out there, unless you have an effective connection to the public in helping to understand what's important to them, but also helping them to understand the reasons for the decisions you're looking to make, you're not going to create sustainable policy. And I think if there's anything that we've seen across the country, whether it's on issues around public safety or issues around education, that because of technology and its ease of organizing or the way that it can easily organize citizens, that governments are having to be much more proactive in engaging and informing their residents. Obviously, this can happen most easily at the local level. But again, as I said before, I think what is interesting by demonstrated in that first executive memorandum back in 2009 is that it shows that the federal government is also moving in this direction as well.
Thanks for sharing that, Pete. I'm going to give our speakers just a moment to think about their closing remarks and let you know where you can go to find out more information about their work. So Debbie Lynn, as we mentioned, is the president of Coffee Party USA, and her website is coffeepartyusa.com. If you want to learn more about Liz Joyner's work with the Village Square, you can go to tallahassee.tothevillagesquare.org. And to learn more about the work that Pete Peterson is doing with Pepperdine, you can go to publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. And so I would like to take the remaining time that we have here to give our speakers a moment to tell you a little bit more about, given what we've talked about, something that they would like to leave our listeners with that they can do today or a next step that they can make to create change in their own lives and in their own communities. So Debbie Lynn, let's start off with you.
Sure. I'm actually going to bounce off of the last thing Pete said just a little bit, because the citizens portion of government transparency is understanding and forgiveness and not taking everything that is made public and turning it into a weapon to use against our government and elected officials. It's our job to be, to hold accountable everything that happens, but not necessarily to persecute mistakes, if you will, or things that are not the way we want them to be. I think as a country, we not only need to learn the art, you know, the art of compromise, and it's not a dirty word, but we also need to learn and provide grace to others when we don't get our way 100% of the time. We're not toddlers. We are adults all managing very complex situations and issues, and we are all doing the best we can, and I think having that understanding as a citizen and that trust in our fellow human beings that we are all doing the best we can will go a long way toward rebuilding the trust in each other so that we can actually have the society that we want to live in.
Thank you, Debbie Lynn. Liz, what would you like to close with?
So I think I'd like to share that notion that you really can start small here. You can start with whatever scale is immediately in front of you. At one of our recent forums on race, we offered the attendees the challenge that you just do something about what's immediately around you. And to underscore the idea, they were all left with 5-foot tape measures. And so we called that their 5-foot challenge. And we're checking back with them in a year to do it. And so what you do can be small, and it still can have incredible impact. In some ways, we've found ourselves in a place where all of our habits have become something that tears down the space that's between us and creates more space and tears down the connections between us. And so very much what we need to be doing is reversing that. And it's incredibly doable. It truly is. We just have to decide that we're going to do it.
Thank you for that. Pete, what would you like to close with in your final thoughts?
At the end of the training work that we do, I always tell the participants that I know I facilitated an effective public process when a citizen comes up to me afterwards and says, "Man, Pete, I'm glad I don't have to make this decision." And that response only happens when participants understand that as much as they may have come to this public process event with a kind of silver bullet solution, I call it, that when it's brought into a discussion around competing opinions and also impact on them, that things get a lot more complicated. And to kind of go off of what Debbie Lynn just said, I think when we're doing public engagement well, there's a certain degree of humility that people experience when they realize that their opinion isn't the only one in the room. And unfortunately, most of our public processes only exacerbate this dynamic. It's one person says one thing for 3 minutes, the next person says another thing for 3 minutes, and as has been discussed before, not only is that not helpful in actually engaging citizens one to another, but it's also, I think, dissuaded many people from participating if that's their only point of engagement. Having said all that, there is a remarkable change happening in how we do public engagement, particularly at the local level, and a remarkable amount of awareness on the part, not just of citizens, but of government officials, that the public process is broken and needs to be changed. And so I think it's an extremely exciting time, just to go back to my opening remarks, to be in public policy, and especially around this particular field of how do we engage and listen to citizens in the formation of public policy. And it's happening because government officials understand that what they're doing has not been working, and we're approaching this immense demographic shift, this transition in the leadership of our local and even all the way up to federal government with the retirement of baby boomers. And in that, I think there's a terrific opportunity to really change how we do government.
Fabulous. I think that we heard a lot about a number of different opportunities for how to create change, where change is happening, and some great strategies from you guys about how to really enable and empower learning from those that are different from us and creating more opportunities for civic engagement in our communities. So thank you very much for your time and participation. It's been a great session here with Debbie Lynn, Liz, and Pete. And thank you all for listening in.
Thank you for joining us for the American Citizen Summit, brought to you by the SHIFT Network. To add this powerful collection of teachings to your personal library, visit americancitizensummit.com/upgrade. To learn more about our global community of people evolving their consciousness and our culture, visit theshiftnetwork.com. Thank you again for joining us and for sharing this empowering wisdom with your friends and family.